Welcome to the Disability Sport Info Show, the podcast that explores academic knowledge about disability sport. My name is Dr. Chris Brown, and I'm an academic with an expertise in disability sport. Each episode, I focus on a specific topic of disability sport and speak to academic experts to understand the area in more depth. So join me and listen to the Disability Sport Info Show, who get an expert view on disability sport. Welcome to the podcast. So I'm joined by two deaf athletes today. So we've got Nathan Young, who is a swimmer, and we have Claire Stancliffe, who is a footballer. They will, of course, explain more about their careers as we have a chat later on today. So the purpose of today's session will be to get these athletes' experience of what it's like to be a deaf athlete in a GB system. So I think to start off, guys, for those who aren't aware, could you please briefly explain to the listeners your career as an elite athlete? Nathan, why don't we start with you first of all?
Yeah, so I started swimming from a young age and I was asked to join a club. I sort of like went from there, but when I was 14, I joined GB Deaf Swimming Club. And then a year later, I was heading to my first international competition in Texas. I was 15 at the time, so I was one of the youngest going. And then I followed by Deaf Olympics 2 years later, where I won a bronze medal as part of the relay team. And I've been to 5 competitions since, and now I'm ranked 4th in the world.
Oh, wow. Okay, excellent. And just for those listeners who aren't aware, what is the Deaf Olympics?
It's basically an Olympics for deaf athletes specifically, and it's all athletes are deaf, and yeah, it's a separate from the power, it's just everyone's deaf.
And so Claire, would you be able to explain to the listeners what your career has been like so far, please?
I first started playing football when I was about 4 or 5 years old. I played for my primary school, the girls and the boys football team, so I played for both. But I didn't really know any other deaf people until I was about 18. I was invited to a deaf tournament, just by the side thing. And it was there that the England head coach scouted me. So that was in 2007. And since then, I've been to every single 11-a-side deaf international tournament since. So I've been to Deaf Olympics, World Cups, European Championships.
So you're talking about, you know, as a deaf athlete, you didn't really necessarily know what the options were or maybe people who were playing themselves. So how would you assess the coverage of deaf elite sport in the UK in terms of media coverage?
I think there's a lot more that can be done in terms of coverage. I think over the past few years, things have certainly been taken to the next level in terms of that. And now we've been seen on TV. They've started to use YouTube at the Deaf Olympics so they can show live games. So things are starting to gradually get better, but there's always room for improvement, especially in the mainstream media. Just being able to show people what we do, especially with that funding.
Yes, and that's an interesting segue to have a chat with Nathan about this. So Nathan, you've got a campaign going on Twitter about the fact that there is a lack of funding. And for listeners who aren't necessarily aware, usually UK Sport, that is the main funder of elite sport in the UK, is pretty much dominated via a power sport perspective. I think that's fair to say. So, you know, traditionally UK Sport have done a no compromise approach to funding where Olympic and Paralympic sports that are deemed to be most likely to get medals have been awarded funding. It's been slightly changed in recent years, but deaf sport traditionally has not received the same level of funding as para sport as well. So Nathan, would you be able to kind of chat about what your thoughts and experiences are about the funding situation and also to let listeners know about your campaign and why you feel this campaign is required?
Deaf funding, well, especially in the sports we're in, has been non-existent. So we've not really had any sort of funding. So for the past 5 competitions that I've been to, I've raised probably about up to 15,000 just to go to these competitions. So I was relying on family, friends and, you know, close ones to sort of raise the money for me. So that really started my campaign to get the funding from the government, because I've gone round in circles. I've asked my local government bodies from England. They've tried to pass it on to British Swimming. British Swimming said they follow what the government say. So ultimately, it's got the government decide. Yeah, they come back with, yeah, we only fund power and Olympic sports. And even though I try and go to companies and say, can I have some funding from, you know, big companies? And they say, no, we only follow what the government are telling us to give. So I'm going round and round in circles, and I've got to the point where I'm training 20 plus hours a week and I'm trying to fund this off my back. I'm 23 now and I'm trying to live, you know, and try and buy a house, try and buy a car, you know, all these things put a pause for me to continue swimming. So it's become very hard at the moment.
And presumably you have a full-time job as well, Nathan, to try and you know, support your living needs?
9 to 5 jobs, and that's what I can get. So I did a bit of lifeguarding because that was the only time I could sort of fit around it. But I want a career in audiology, which is going to be a full-time job. But ultimately, I've sort of like had to put that on hold. But it's getting very difficult to do that.
Yeah. Also like to bring in Claire here as well, and also continue your chat as well, Nathan. But so why do you think the government are setting their position saying that we only fund Olympic and Paralympic sports? Why should deaf sport not get funding? What do you think? Why do you think they're suggesting that? And what can be done to try and change their position?
I think it all comes down to the fact the Olympics and the Paralympics are recognised at such a high level, whereas the Deaf Olympics isn't. So I think that plays a massive part in it. There are a lot of discussions going on at the moment to try and get the government to recognise deaf athletes and the Deaf Olympics. So I think there is progress being made. It will just take a bit of time for that to come. But as soon as that recognition comes in, it opens so many doors for funding. So it's such a small step that we need, but it will be massive.
And it's tricky though, isn't it? Because it's like a chicken and egg scenario. You know, how do you get the recognition and the media awareness without, you know, media's putting on the events that you're doing and kind of helping to promote it? And that will probably require support to get that going. But if you don't get that, then the government may be like, well, why should we be funding it? Because it's not a media imperative or not enough, you know, interest in it. How do you break that cycle? How do you get to a position where you can say, look, clearly there's emphasis and momentum behind deaf sport, so you need to fund it? What would you suggest as athletes who are involved in the sport?
I'm not asking the government to fund us as such. It's just give us that recognition, because once that door's opened, that gives us avenues to get funding from elsewhere, like Sport England, for example. It's like with the Olympics and the Paralympics, I'm not sure how it works, but I don't think the funding necessarily comes directly from the government. It comes from other avenues. So that's the sort of thing that we're kind of looking at going down. Just get that recognition, allow us to be recognised, and then hopefully the funding should just gradually come in some other way.
Okay. And Nathan, any thoughts on that?
The government decide where the money goes ultimately. So the National Lottery give a lot of money to the government, and then the government decides how it's like distributed through UK Deaf Sport. Yeah, but I agree with Claire that once that one thing comes, that starts like a snowball effect that everything starts to follow. Whether it's, you know, car companies might say, oh, we've got a bit of funding here, you can have a little bit. But they go, no, we've got what the government are telling us to fund.
And what does recognition mean to you? So if you would get this recognition, what would that look like? And what would that be for you as athletes?
For me, it would just be recognised as an athlete. I think at the moment, we just feel like we're just grassroots players in a way. Like, we're not actual athletes, even though we are. And it would just be nice to have that recognition and be seen on that level.
So even when I go to my competitions and say, like, nationals, whatever, I would wear my GB cap because I don't see myself as this professional athlete as much as I swim internationally. I'm not looking at myself because I don't get recognised like a professional athlete. I look at myself as not that either. So the recognition from the government, from everyone, would then give me more confidence to show that.
I think some people potentially don't really understand what impact deafness has on you as athletes. I don't know if that's fair. I mean, I remember watching a BBC breakfast clip about a deaf tennis player and, you know, the impact that being deaf had on his performance and how he had to adapt and adjust his game and all the skill level that was required for it. But as a kind of general viewer, do you feel like people are aware of how it actually makes a difference and an impact on your abilities to perform as athletes?
So one of the main problems for swimmers at the moment is, especially when they're racing this country, is the start system. I've had an ongoing thing with the Swim England about trying to get this changed. So when I go to the Olympics, they have a traffic light system. So where I'd get on the block, obviously taking into consideration, can't hear any of the beeps or anything. And so red, get on the block, orange, take your marks, and then green, go. But in this country, they only have this one flash to say go. So I don't know when to take your marks, I don't know when to get on the block. So I'm having to look, constantly scan my surroundings. So I'm looking at the referee who could be 10 metres away, trying to look for any sort of, like, could he put some microphone in front of his mouth? So I'm looking for any sort of changes to his facial expression to know that he's saying, take him off, and then I go. So I feel like that's just one example of the challenges I face when I compete.
What about you, Claire? Obviously, different sport, obviously a team sport. Nathan's on his own pretty much, you know, as a obviously just a relay, but as an individual, pretty much. What about you, Claire? What's your thoughts on that question?
In terms of football, when we're playing on a national level, you can't wear your hearing aids or your cochlear implant. They have to be removed before you enter the field of play so that everyone's on the same level playing field. So there's literally no sound whatsoever for some of this. And the linesmen normally have flags in mainstream football, but also in deaf football, the referee has one. So the first official will have a flag. So whenever they blow the whistle, they will obviously wave the flag. And obviously there's a little bit of leeway in terms of when they do blow the whistle, if you play on, you won't get penalised because you didn't hear the whistle sort of thing. Apart from that, I think it's more in terms of everyone, like every individual, every player is different with how they cope with it. So some players might, it might affect their balance. I especially notice it when it's dark because obviously I've got no hearing, but also now my vision's impacted because it's not as easy to see. So that affects my training. In terms of training, it's like, if I wanted to go out for a run, I would never go out for a run in the dark on my own just because I can't hear what's going on. So I don't feel safe. So that has an impact on what sort of training I do. And then there's the fact that if we're going out for work, like to work all day, lit reading all day, it is exhausting. So when you get home, you just don't have the energy to train, but we have to train. We have to push ourselves through that. So it does get to the point where we do need kind of maybe more recovery days or just a bit more downtime just to recover from not just the training, but our own daily lives.
Yeah, really interesting thoughts. And I don't think necessarily some listeners would appreciate that kind of daily reality that you were saying. Obviously, I don't know how much you will know, but obviously you would have competed internationally. How does the UK system compare to, I don't know, some other countries in Europe, for example, or maybe even in America or Australia, whoever it might be? How does our system compare in terms of the status and funding for deaf athletes?
So from my experience, Russia's always been a country that wins medals and all that. And from what I know, they're paid professionals. I remember back in Taiwan, I think if they won a gold medal, they got 60,000 euros each. Silver was 40,000 and bronze was 20,000. Don't quote me on those figures, but it was something like that. So they were getting that for just winning the medal. We were paying to go. So we were self-funded. So that there was a massive difference in performance levels. So we were all really fit like that. I think America have been very similar to the UK in a way, but they've been self-funded. Nathan, have you got any specific countries?
Probably not the right time to say, but the Russia are massively funded. They take a team of like 30-odd swimmers to their competition. I was one swimmer going to the past two competitions I went to, I was the one swimmer from my country going, because a lot of the swimmers can't fund themselves. So obviously Russia taking 30-odd swimmers and paying for every single one of them. Russia's one. I think Ukraine take a big team as well. Talking about them two countries, I came for third, second and first, were all fully funded. So as Claire was saying, massive difference in performance levels. I came for the ones that came before me were all funded.
Interesting. I wasn't expecting you to say Russia, both of you, I have to say. That was a bit of a curveball, but interesting that. Yeah, Ukraine do well in the Paralympics, don't they? So they historically have done quite well in disability competitions. When you were going through the pathways in your sports, were the coaches non-disabled or were they deaf coaches? And also when you were playing the sport, were you competing alongside non-disabled individuals or even individuals without deafness? Nathan, I'll start with you, then we'll go to you, Claire.
Yeah, so I've been probably most around hearing swimmers and hearing coaches. It's only really when I went to a deaf competition for the first time that I actually sort of swam with deaf athletes and had a deaf coach. So yeah, I've been around the mainstream swimming world for most of my career, other than when I go to internationals competition. And when I went to the past two competitions, no coach came with me, so I had to fund my own coach who was hearing at that time. So that's the international competition I've been to where hearing coaches actually come to.
Yeah, so when I was growing up, as I mentioned previously, I didn't know any other coach or player that was deaf until I was about 18, and that was when I first got involved with the England team. And even then the coaches were hearing, so the players were deaf but the coaches were hearing, so the communication barriers were really obvious. As time's gone on, you know, with funding, more accessibility in players, there have been deaf players or deaf individuals that have their coaching badges, and they've started to come in to the system a bit more. In terms of pathways, there wasn't really any pathways when I was younger. I think it's only just more recently those pathways have been created. There's so much more work to do on that.
Yeah, so in terms of when you were young, how were you spotted as talented individuals? Or was it just you as individuals going to, you know, whoever it might be and saying, look, I really want to play, and then you kind of, your talent shone as a result of that?
For me, it was, I was just invited by another deaf 18-year-old. She said, come play for my team at a deaf tournament. And I was like, I don't know any deaf people. You know, it was a bit of a massive culture shock in a way. So I just went along, just played. And that's when the England head coach, she spotted me. She was there and she came up to me and said, can I have your contact details? And since then, I've been to every tournament since.
Okay. So it's quite random, really. So if your friend hadn't have invited you, you may not have been spotted by the head coach.
Yeah. I mean, I didn't even know about deaf football. So it's kind of like, why didn't I know about that? That should have been something I should have been aware of, but I just wasn't.
So you just played football, but you didn't know there was necessarily a deaf pathway that existed.
I was just playing football in a mainstream environment. Now, that's what I was just doing. And then there wasn't any particular pathways for deaf footballers at that time. It was just, if you were good enough, you're straight into the main, like the senior team. So yeah, there was no particular pathway. And even now, there's no deaf women's or deaf girls leagues in the UK. It's still, you play mainstream football, and if you're good enough to go into the England pathway, then you get signposted into that.
Interesting. So it relies on people having the confidence and the ability to be able to participate in a mainstream setting in order to be able to have the opportunity to then go into a deaf team. And Nathan, what about you? Do you have similar experiences, or was it slightly different?
Yeah, it's completely the same sort of situation. I was actually just swimming, like, you know, normal, like, swimming lessons, and a lifeguard who was a coach said, do you want to join the club? So I joined the club. And then when I was about 14 or 15, I then heard about deaf sport, deaf swimming. So it took me 15 years to hear about the Deaf Olympics. So something that's been so run for since, what, 1924, for me to hear that at the age of 15. And my mum and dad had never even heard of it as well. Just shows that there's a lack of recognition in deaf sport. There's no pathways other than just going to a GB deaf swimming. But it's like Claire, you have to swim in the mainstream hearing world to sort of get anywhere within the deaf world. There's no pathways, or you can't go on in training camps and stuff like that.
Yeah, it's interesting, isn't it? So yeah, even through school, you weren't, you know, your parents or yourselves weren't made aware of the Deaf Olympics and the opportunities to participate in a deaf environment. And yeah, if you are an individual who is not comfortable participating in a mainstream setting, then it's pretty tricky to get into a deaf squad. So I think it's fair to say, and I don't know if you guys agree, but I think it's fair to say that the high performance sports system for deaf athletes is very underdeveloped in this country. Is that a fair statement to say?
Yeah, I agree.
Yeah. Claire, probably you're also in agreement with that.
Yeah, no, absolutely. There's just so much to do. That's across all of the deaf sports as well.
Yeah.
It's not just individual sports. It's literally every single deaf sport.
Okay. So in this hypothetical scenario, you are both in charge of creating a world-class deaf sports system. How would you go about doing it? And what would you require to be in place to create a system that maximises your talent?
I think the one thing that I would do straight away is just give the recognition, because I feel like once that recognition comes, I think everything just comes with it, whether that's funding, whether that's, you know, social media presence, or whether that's respect and everything that comes along with it. So I'd say the recognition is the key thing. And obviously, with the funding, I expect it to just be like what the power athletes get. We are power sport in a way, but we're just under a different organisation, Deaf Olympics.
Okay, thank you, Nathan. Claire, what about you?
For me, yeah, similar. The recognition and the funding, that's got to be top priority in terms of getting that in play. And then it's just creating that expansive, supported pathway with a high level of accessibility. So we're never going to get deaf leagues in swimming, football and basketball. You know, that's never going to happen due to, we just don't have the numbers to do that. But how can we support those athletes in a mainstream environment? So particularly in football, I've noticed that our players struggle to maybe go up to another level purely because they don't have the accessibility. You know, they're going into teams where they can't understand what's going on. So how can we provide support to allow them to participate at a higher level, which will then just push everyone's standards up? And that's not just for like 18 plus, I'm talking about for children as well. We've got to allow them to be able to play a sport where it's accessible for them.
Yeah, it's a really interesting point. It's not even just sport, you know, it's also, like I said, education, you know, being aware of the opportunities to support people who want to go into a sporting route. And obviously the funding's important, the media coverage of deaf events. Now, for being cynical, mainstream organisations, they're not going to support causes without a funding imperative or a funding link. Hopefully some will, but relying on morals and kind of the goodwill of organizations probably is not going to help. So helping to kind of support organizations so they want to and need to be able to support deaf athletes probably will also help to then provide those kind of pathways in place. Okay, any other thoughts about the system before we kind of move on to the final question? Anything that we haven't addressed so far?
I just think in terms of the media, that's something else that can be worked on, because I find that the media, sort of kind of a general thing, that always report on something the good that's happened. Whereas, like, for example, when we did a fundraising campaign 6-7 years ago, they never helped us get that campaign off, like, get that started. It was only when somebody from the Premier League donated money that they started to report on it. So, you know, it's kind of just trying to maximise what we can use, like the media, try and just make those contacts and those relationships to try and, you know, increase our presence as such.
Yeah, really interesting point. Okay, so finally, what are your ambitions for 2023 for both of you in terms of as elite athletes?
So hopefully, if the funding comes along and certain funding, then I'll be attending the World Deaf Championships in Argentina this year in August, and then hopefully followed by Deaf Olympics in 2026 into Japan.
Excellent. Thank you, Nathan. Claire, what about you?
For me, it's a bit of a difficult one because we don't really know what's happening with deaf football at the moment. It's a bit up in the air. And it's been a really tough 6 years as such in terms of having an injury, then COVID hitting, all the tournaments cancelled, and then we weren't allowed to go to the Deaf Olympics. So mentally, that's been like, how do I keep myself going? So for me, it's just about enjoying my football, but also still trying to push. Same with Nathan for the Deaf Olympics. We know that's in 2025, but it's almost like a four-year cycle. You have to train from the moment that the Deaf Olympics finish to the next one. You're still training. You're still in that process.
What's been the issue in football in terms of the last few years? Obviously, you said about COVID, but you said it's up in the air at the moment in terms of football. What did you mean by that?
Before COVID hit, the European Championships were cancelled last minute by the organisers, so we couldn't go to that. That was in 2019. Then in 2020, we were supposed to have the World Cup, but that got postponed because of COVID. The Deaf Olympics was supposed to be held in 2021, but that got postponed because of COVID to last year. And then probably about 5 or 6 months before, we were told GB won't be attending the Deaf Olympics due to security and COVID, which we weren't expecting because we were only probably three countries that didn't go. Everybody else did. So, you know, it's kind of like, how much more do we need to give, sort of thing. And then it's just now we're just waiting to see what happens in terms of competitions moving forward, because, you know, obviously the impact of COVID has messed the schedule up in a way. So we're just waiting to see what happens.
I think it's probably fair to say, and there was some, in an academic world anyway, there was some talk about when we got back to some sporting action after COVID, or at least during COVID, but, you know, after the first lockdown, if we can bring our minds back to that time, men's sport were prioritised. I think that's probably fair to say. Then women's sport was kind of on the back burner. And so presumably you've got Paralympic sport was ahead of deaf sport. So deaf sport was probably at the bottom of all the priority lists in terms of events. I don't know if that's fair for me to say, but that's what it seems to me has happened. Would you agree?
The thing about deaf sport and Paralympic and Olympic sports, one, they're completely different organisations. So they were doing it in their own time. Obviously, they pushed it back a year, which was fair enough, but they still went ahead with it. So I went to a competition last November, so it was still able to go. I think it was just coming towards the end of COVID, so I was still able to go to Poland. But obviously, between Poland and Brazil, it's completely different. So it's more like an in-country decision not to go.
Right. Okay. Well explained. All right. Well, I don't have any other questions. Is there anything else you want to add?
Nothing really. Just if anyone out there can give us a platform to raise awareness and get recognition, please get in contact with us. I think Nathan will be the same. I'm happy to do whatever. I'm quite flexible in terms of interviews and stuff like that. The more the better.
Yeah.
Thank you ever so much, guys. It's been really interesting learning about your experiences as elite athletes. Hopefully in a small way, or maybe even a big way, this podcast will help with that recognition in terms of deaf sport, hopefully, in a way. So that's it from me. And I'd like to thank you both for your participation and contribution. And I look forward to catching up with you both soon.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah, thank you.
That's it. That's all we have time for. Thanks for listening to another episode of the Disability Sport Info Show. Stay tuned for another episode. Until then, goodbye. You've been listening to the Disability Sport Info Show, academic insights into disability sport.